I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us to celebrate the launch. Today is the actual launch day of Jason Ockenbauer's Revolutionary Acts, Love and Brotherhood in Black Gay Britain. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling okay. I didn't expect so many people to be here. Even though it was sold out, I was like, oh, you're all here. But luckily, I always take off my glasses for these events, so I can't recognise a single face. It really helps.
So we met in 2020.
Yeah.
When you came to my house where I was living at the time to interview me. And that was sort of at the beginning almost of you writing this book. So it feels like I've sort of been along for the journey.
Yeah.
Which feels great. Can you tell us what the starting point was? What was the motivation behind writing this book?
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess like I can most concretely pinpoint it to when I was a student and I was writing my dissertation. So I was writing a sociology dissertation about HIV amongst black men who have sex with men, you know, which is the kind of like technical medical term. And I was trying to find any literature on AIDS and HIV-based activism in the UK from like the kind of like 1980s, 1990s period. And I was coming up very short. Like I might find like a flyer without any context, but I couldn't find any kind of like sustained narrative. And then I was starting to think, well, is there anything at all to do with, you know, black gay men, black men who have sex with men, you know, in Britain back in those days. I just watched the African-American film Tongues Untied, which is a really beautiful narrative about, you know, African-American gay men. Obviously, it looks at AIDS, but it also looks at, you know, family acceptance, their relationship to the straight community, and also culture. And I just realised, oh, none of this stuff is coming up. But the name that did keep on coming up was this guy called Mark Thompson. So I thought, let me get in touch with him. He'll know. He can, like, you know, help me out with my dissertation. But when I finished the dissertation, I graduated, I thought, this guy is so interesting. And also, we get along very well. So, you know, I might still keep up this relationship. You know, how many people can say that they're friends with, you know, an older black gay man who's like 30 years older and is able to, like, share all of this wisdom and all of these stories? So then, you know, I meet up with him in Brixton, you know, just as friends, and he told me all of these incredible things about like his life back in the 1980s, about the fact that the house that he lived in Brixton was a former squat for the South London Gay Liberation Front, which was then turned into a housing co-op. And I was starting to like learn more and more about some of his friends and about the fact that there was this just strong presence of a black gay community in Brixton. So I just thought, do you know what? People should know this. Like, people should know that Brixton had this, you know, thriving black gay community, that it was, you know, getting up to a lot of activism, that it was, you know, at the forefront of culture. And I just thought, I want to do something with this. I want to record it somehow. I didn't know it was going to be a book. It could have been like an oral history project. It could have been a podcast. It could have been literally anything. But then, you know, circumstances happened. I ended up getting an agent, and my agent was like to me, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I was like, well, there's this thing that I've never really known what to do with, where I'm like, I know these men, they've got really cool stories, and I don't know what to do. And I then, you know, came to the conclusion, actually, like, what if I brought all these stories together, had it in a very specific setting, which is like Brixton, South London, and just let them talk about their lives with me kind of like shaping it, narrating it. So that was the kind of like process and evolution, and that just got us straight to, you know, the book deal. And then the real work started.
Right, indeed. So was there something, I mean, you mentioned African-American narratives and stories pertaining to HIV and AIDS among black men who have sex with men. Was there something about like the structure of the archival evidence of that that influenced your research?
What I found when I was looking at African-American literature and also this film on Tamsin Hyde was that it was a real blend of narratives. It was never ever, it was always cohesive, but it was never singular. So you'd have these anthologies like In the Life by Joseph Beam, and obviously you'd have the film Tamsin Hyde, and they would just throw in so many different elements to speak to one broader thing about, you know, this cohort and community of black women. So that kind of influenced me to be able to say, you know what, this book can be about, you know, really hardcore activism and like going up against the state or going up against an institution. And it can also be about, you know, sex parties and what people are getting up to in abandoned buildings and things like that. So it allowed me to write something which really kind of reconciled and just like placed together the real social party elements and the kind of more gritty political elements and, you know, some of the drama, some of the sad moments, some of the happy moments. I would just thought like this book doesn't have to be like one consistent tone. It can kind of like bounce up and down, basically.
Yeah, because, you know, this could have easily been like an academic text. But, you know, what's brilliant about The Voice is it's very conversational. It's very much like you're standing in a bar next to these elders and they're sort of passing down knowledge and information about those times. How did you manage to earn their trust, first of all, and create this incredible space whereby they were so honest with you?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know what, I do think about that question of trust and ethics. And sometimes I try to think about, like, how does this not sound manipulative, right? It's kind of like, oh, you know, I kind of, like, befriend them and then they trust me and then they tell me all their secrets. And it's like, I don't want to, like, you know...
You're a good journalist.
I don't want to ever frame it like that, but I always remember thinking, like, would I want to... If there was no kind of, like, commercial literary motivation, would I want to know this person, have a chat with them, learn about them? And it's like, yes, that's the case. And I know that because, you know, even way before I'd started any of this work, if I'd ever met, like, an elder black gay person, like, you know, we talk about, like, having, like, you know, your queer father, your queer son in the community. It's like, I was always keen to have those kind of, like, queer father figures and, like, meet them and, like, hang out with them. So I kind of just saw it as a continuation of that. For that reason, you know, all of the men in the book are people that I also personally liked. I mean, I didn't come across someone that I disliked, but even if they had a great story and I personally felt like we don't get along, like, oh, I dislike you, I probably wouldn't have included them because there had to be the authenticity of the relationship. And it is conversational, it's chatty. I wanted to keep it really gossipy. I remember when I was, like, first setting out, like, writing a proposal, I was thinking, does this need to, you know, basically I had this idea that I was like, I'm going to read lots of Stuart Hall and I'm going to read lots of James Baldwin. I'm going to read all of these like references and make it really dense.
So everyone can see how clever.
so everyone can see how clever I am. And then I just thought, but why? I sometimes feel like there's a pressure with non-fiction to be so heavily referenced and be this kind of like intellectual flex. But like, look at all the books I read to write a book. And it's like, actually, I can get the material from what these people are saying and from these conversations. And obviously, one big conceptual idea about the book is, you know, the concept of archiving. And I thought that like, this book in itself is also a kind of like timepiece and an archive of the time in which these conversations happened. So it preserves what they say, but it also preserves the relationship that I had as this like historian, researcher, friend with this community of black gay men in Brixton.
Speaking of archives, I mean, these men are all walking archives. Yeah. So I suppose it's good at this point to say that there are magnificent seven, these seven amazing black gay men whom Jason has interviewed and written about. So do you want to sort of talk briefly about, well, first of all, let's introduce them. So we've got Ted Brown.
Yeah.
We'll speak about all of these different people individually. So Ted Brown, Durgarb Richards, Alex Owolade, DJ Biggie C, Mark Thompson, Ajamu, and I'm missing one.
Dennis Carney.
Sorry, Dennis, seven. If you're here. I didn't actually forget you. These men are all walking archives. And I guess like when we're talking about any form of social history that sort of rotates around sexuality and gender, race, you know, because we're not the majority culture, if you like, that our stories don't always get sort of prioritized in terms of being documented in the moment.
Yeah.
And so you're relying on memory. You're relying on, and you know, memories can be unreliable when the events that create these memories are in spaces where alcohol is consumed, where drugs are taken, where people are having sex and losing their minds, like, et cetera, et cetera. So, but what you've done is you've almost, like, you know, taken so much material from each person and then looked at where the sort of pinch points are and then gone into the research to sort of... So what was the process like in terms of the archive, like going into the archive and comparing that sort of existing archive that can be found, like in the Ruckus archive, for example, which you might want to explain, and then having these conversations with these men?
Yeah, I mean, the archive question was difficult, right, because it was so limited. So thankfully, there was the Ruckus archive at the London Metropolitan University, and this was started by Ajama Rex, who was in the book, and also by Toph Campbell, because, you know, they had this compulsion in the early 2000s to say, well, other places are not doing this, so someone should actually, you know, come and, like, you know, collect these different materials so that there is some kind of preservation. But often, you know, these men would be talking about events that weren't necessarily, you know, recorded at the time or intentionally, because, you know, if you're going out to a nightclub, you're not necessarily thinking some nosy kid in 30 years is going to really want the flyer for this. So they're just not necessarily thinking in those terms. I mean, thankfully, because, you know, things weren't digital back then, they might have, by chance or by luck, have been able to keep hold of, you know, these different materials. So as much as I used the Ruckus archive, there were also things that they had themselves. There was a bit of an issue where sometimes someone would talk about being in a documentary on Channel 4, and I would really believe them. But I'd be searching up, I would not even be able to find, like, a single reference to this documentary. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to have to get really creative with how I find this. But there were instances where, you know, they would just have, like, a tape of it, you know, in their attic somewhere, and they'd bring it down and be like, oh yeah, I've had this for like 30 years, I've not used it since. And then it cost like £70 to burn it to a CD, and no one's got a CD player, so it costs another £50 to burn it to a USB stick. So it's great personal expense. But then sometimes I'm there thinking, you know, what if this is like the only copy of this, like, very specific documentary from 1990 that no one seems to remember other than the people that were in it? So yeah, the archive was complicated. And what was difficult is that obviously you're working with people who are talking from memory. So sometimes they will really confidently say, so yeah, this happened in 1982 and this happened in 1986. And then one thing I did do is I went to the voice archives in the British Library. The reason for that is because I thought, well, if this is like the kind of like black national black newspaper, it must have mentioned some of these gay men, even if it wasn't within the context of them being gay. So I was kind of like, yeah, going through every single page, like, can I see any homosexuals? So sometimes I would, you know, get this information from them, and I'd see this, like, maybe perhaps in the Voice newspaper, maybe if I managed to find a smidgen of something online, and then the dates wouldn't match, and I was doing, this book was a lot more maths than I thought it would be. So then I was asking them, are you sure it was this date? Because I can't be sure if their memory has failed, or if this was, like, poor reporting, or whatever. And getting into that sometimes got really, really frustrating. But, yeah, it was a difficult but interesting process, but I also think that it encouraged me to be more creative as well. Like, the fact that I was having to work with memory and kind of like fill in the gaps meant I actually think strengthened the writing. And the reason I think that is because there was only one topic that's not in the book, and it's not in the book for this reason, that was actually properly, meticulously, like, kept. You could find it online. And this was murder music. So murder music is this kind of like homophobic, you know, dancehall music, which is coming out of Jamaica. And I thought, yeah, of course, the Telegraph, the Times, the Guardian are all over that. So there's just all of these kind of like online sources to do this. And I remember I was trying to write this chapter, and I was just like, you know what, this feels really out of key with the rest of the chapters, because it's not as reliant on these kind of like fading memories. It's less like me kind of like putting conversation out of these men. And it's more me kind of being like, well, this is what the Guardian said, this is what the Telegraph said, this is what the Times said. So I just cut it, and I was like, I need to actually just come back to that later, perhaps a paperback or something, and think about that again. But yeah, the archive was a complicated issue. Sometimes it threw up more questions or even like more problems and boundaries, but it was also good to know that it was there. And I kind of hope that, you know, this book then adds to the archive, so it's almost like a self-fulfilling cycle.
The first line, you've just made me remember, the first line of the book, which you're thinking about changing, please don't. Researching Black British history often feels like a rescue effort and a race against time.
Yeah.
That's a striking opening line. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
It's going to sound really glib, but I was always very explicit about the fact that these men could have just been dead. Like, that just is the fact. In fact, I remember partway through the research, someone who was very close to them, in fact, died of prostate cancer. And also when they speak so much about, you know, men who had died, who men who, if they were alive, would have been people who would have been in my book because of the incredible work they did and what they spoke to. So I just thought, you know, actually it is incredibly urgent to be able to get these people to talk as soon as possible before it is very literally too late. And when I was like, you know, learning about all of these different dead people that they were talking about, I just thought like how much history and how much, you know, witnessing of, you know, different historical moments has been lost just like that. Part of the motivation, inspiration behind writing this book was the death of my dad. I'm always someone who asks a million questions and is like super nosy. And I remember just thinking, so my dad died when I was 19. And it was kind of like in my late teenage years, early 20s, that I was becoming like really politically conscious. And I remember even just thinking like, I wonder what my dad even thought like politically, or I wonder what it was like for him when he came here in like the 1990s as like a West African migrant, things like that. And it's a bit like, oh, I can never ask him those questions, even just for my own satisfaction. So the urgency of that was just repeated to me time and time again, because the specter of death was absolutely completely unavoidable. But also it wasn't just that, it was also the fact that, you know, memories fail, but also there are differences, there were different extremities of that as well, right? So I'm very into fashion. So there was one man who I won't name, you know, for the sake of privacy, who used to like run like a fashion store in Brixton Market, and, you know, apparently was featured in British Vogue and all sorts of things. I thought fabulous. This is absolutely a chapter. And I remember speaking to the guys and we're like, okay, so, you know, so where is he? And they were like, well, we've not heard from him in like 5 years. Last we heard, he was living in Oval, but we're not sure. I thought, would anyone be able to get a number or know someone who knows? Literally, so this guy would, you know, have house parties, drag competitions in his house, was just known for, you know, wearing wigs and just being really out there, flamboyant, like a real massive regular fixture of the scene. And then like within a decade, just lost all connection. And that's really interesting because we're in a time where we think about ourselves as like constantly connected to people, right? We think about these digital technologies, which means that we're always accessible. But someone was able to be more present and more connected in a time where there were no mobile phones, there wasn't just, you know, the regular email, than they are with these digital communications. So I met him really weirdly. I was coming back from the gym and there was just an old man kind of like hobbling along the pavement, just walking really slowly. And I just stopped and I was just staring at him for like 5 minutes. And I could tell that he was he like knew that I was staring at him, thinking, what the hell is going on? And I was there like, should I go up to him? This is weird. Oh my God, I can't believe this is really happening. I went up to him and I was like, hi, you're this person. He was kind of like, but I kind of reassured him. I was like, oh, I know. I just dropped names of people that I knew. I just name dropped and be like, yeah, I know all these people. People that he was friends with. And he was like, you know, then we like had a bit of conversation. He gave me his number. But I found that he was like suffering from very significant brain damage, which, you know, he told me outright. And I thought, there is no way in hell it is ethical for me to sit this man down and try and get like stories out of him. It would just be completely wrong. But as I was saying, again, with these kind of like, you know, documentaries that people were in, someone had mentioned that he had been in the Channel 4 documentary, which was about like black culture broadly. And he had been in this segment about fashion. And I literally, for the life of me, could not find this documentary for like months. Like, I think when I finally found it, I used so many keywords and it was still on like the 11th page of Google that I found just like a reference.
It's the dark web.
Yeah, like I literally just found a reference and I was like, I think this is it. So it had the name of the director. So I found the director's email and I emailed him thinking, okay, great, he must have a copy of this, right? And he got back to me. He was like, oh, Jason, I'm sorry, that definitely is me because that was my production company. But he was like, I don't remember making this documentary. And yeah, I do not have a copy. And obviously this was the white director. And I thought, okay, this was just a job. For you, this was just a job. For us, this is our culture. This is our heritage, you know, this is evidence of our history. But for you, this was a job. Thank you for the £50 or whatever. And I'm off. I'm not even going to bother keeping this. So I found that so frustrating. And then I contacted the BFI, who had held record of this. And I then was told that, oh, they can get the tape from, I don't know, this like massive archive place where they were like deteriorating. But I'm only allowed to like watch it on the premises of the BFI in like Tottenham Court Road. So I went down there and I watched it. And it was And mate, it was incredible. It was honestly, like, I was just like so gagged by this guy. He was just there, like, he was like dancing, voguing, these incredible designs. He was just so confident. And also, I had been speaking to someone who was speaking in broken communication because of his brain damage. But in this, he's speaking so fluently about like the different, you know, kind of textiles and designs, all of these kind of like African prints that he was like making as well. And like how the kind of commerce and trade of Brixton works. And I thought, this is so amazing. And I went to the, you know, this guy that was there, and I was like, well, can I have this? And he was like, oh, well, you know, it's a bit of a complicated process. You've got to like apply for this and got to pay that and this, that, as like, whatever. So I then, well, obviously I then just went to the room, played it again, and kind of like recorded with my phone the parts that contained this guy. The BFI can sue me all they like. I've still got it on my phone. And then I met up with him and I played it for him, and he was literally in tears. He was like, I've not seen this in like 30 years. I never thought I would see this again. Like, he was so grateful and he was so like overwhelmed just to see these visions of his younger self. And I just thought, like, for me to be able to actually take this, I don't know, maybe put it online, make it super accessible, would cost me so much money, would be, you know, have so much admin behind it. I'd be subject to all of this kind of like copyright, all of this legal bullshit. And the person who made it doesn't even remember that they made it. You know, like, how ridiculous is that? And then it made me think, like, how many kind of, you know, like, black television shows or documentaries or just black materials that we wouldn't even think to know exist are just rotting somewhere in some archive. Like, the only reason I even knew that this existed was because someone mentioned casually, yeah, he was in this documentary, and it still took me months to find. So I just remember, whilst I was writing this book, I just became really radicalized around archiving, where I was just like, there just needs to be like a massive digital project. Even if something seems like the most random, irrelevant tape, it just needs to be digitized. There needs to be more money like put into this preservation, because it's important of us, you know, for the pure sake and pleasure of knowing, right? For me, when I was watching that documentary, it's not like, oh, I was so enlightened or blah, blah, blah. It's like, I just enjoyed watching it, and it was great. It was like, okay, this is what Brixton looked like, and this is what a fashion store in Brixton was doing, and this was the impact that this black gay designer in the 1980s was having. All that could have just been lost, and possibly still could be lost, you know. So when my advance comes on Monday, I'm gonna have to go and buy it. So yeah, just thinking through those issues just made me just so almost kind of angry, because I just thought, like, how much of our culture do we actually own? I just remember thinking about that so much, like, how much of our culture do we own, and like, how much do we even know exists in the first place?
I absolutely agree. And like, you almost sort of made me tear up a little bit speaking there, because It's true. Like, black stories do get lost. And, you know, as, you know, black queer people, we're seen almost as a sort of minority within a minority.
Yeah.
And so what hope do we have almost? You know, the archive does usually only get accessed by certain people. It's very sort of closely gatekept. How do you manage your frustrations? And, you know, I kind of ask this from a sort of broader perspective as well, in terms of self-care in handling this material, because you're dealing with people who both lived through and died during the AIDS crisis, Section 28. You know, how did you sort of manage that, you know, reading through the book? You know, there are moments where the contributors are moved to tears as well. So, you know, can you talk a little bit about how you sort of coped emotionally with the material?
Yeah, the material was very difficult at times, to be honest, like, even just like hearing it fresh. So when Mark Thompson talks about his HIV diagnosis, it's not just the fact of getting this, you know, terrifying diagnosis at a time where you don't know what it means, other than like, well, you know, you're probably going to die.
Should we just give a little bit of context?
Yeah. So to give context, Mark Thompson was diagnosed HIV positive at the age of 17. This was like very, very early days of the epidemic. And this was also a time where people were only really hearing about it like in America, and it hadn't really become like a big news item in the UK just yet. It was kind of like, this is happening in America with gay men. And also, he was the only one out of his friends or community that was diagnosed to his knowledge at that time. So he just felt, you know, incredibly isolated. So there was the kind of sadness of that. And there were times where he talked about the fact that, you know, he really wanted to be a father, and he just, you know, felt like he would not be able to, you know, be a father with his HIV diagnosis, or that, you know, he was really into film and his kind of like creative ambitions really just collapsed, because he thought, you know, what's the point of even planning for next week when I could just die, right? But more than that, it was really difficult to hear just how malicious people were about him, like other black gay men just like gossiping about him, using his status against him. So sometimes he would have like a new romantic partner and he would tell them, you know, I'm HIV positive. And that partner would be like, yeah, I heard from so-and-so. So the kind of like depth of betrayal, it was like super disappointing, but also it had to make it in as well. I had to be faithful to the fact that actually, you know what, people have been and are shitty to each other. There was at no point in this book did I ever want to like censor or rub something out because it was a bit uncomfortable or unpalatable. I always had to sit with those moments. So what I did, the way I coped was that I always wrote the emotion in. If ever I found something that was particularly difficult or shocking, I would write it in. So Dennis Carney was in this documentary in 1990 called Blackout, which was literally just about, you know, being black and gay. And there were these segments where you get like another straight black man who are talking about like how they see black homosexuals as white, you know, and they think they're worse than pedophiles and things like that. And I watched the documentary because this was one of those tapes which cost me like £120 to digitize. But I watched it and I remember watching it feeling really upset, actually. I didn't think I would because I don't usually get upset by the things that I kind of like laugh off homophobia, but it was actually very visceral and I wrote that in. I was like, this was this was difficult to watch. And I thought, well, you know, this is a history, but also, as I said, it's also an archive of me and my conversations and my relationship to this work at this time. So it was very therapeutic actually to be able to say this work affected me. At no point did I want to be this kind of like objective, distant anthropological historian who's like totally removed from the source. I was someone who was like very much invested in it. So I always wrote that. At the same time, I also wrote, you know, I had like a particular flirtation with one of the men, I wrote that in as well. I wrote in every kind of like interaction. So I made sure that I just preserved all of those dynamics.
That's kind of, you know, what distinguishes this book from other, I wouldn't say similar books because there's very much nothing like it in terms of theme.
Unique.
It is unique. but you even call Ajamu an alien superstar. You don't even use the capital.
I actually removed that.
He's
read the book. That was like a placeholder for something else.
But I loved it. It has this kind of incredible friendliness to it, gossip. Like it's not an academic text at all. I mean, it's got the discussion of all the politics and everything, but it's very Gen Z. It's very sort of gossipy. It's very much like, oh, well, here's the tea, girl. Like, you know, that's kind of how it feels. And that's what makes it so sort of like ferociously readable and incredible. So congratulations.
Because no one wants to read a dense academic text. The thing is, and I'm not like going to like throw shade at anyone specific, but like, sometimes you get like these kind of like popular history books. I just think, does anyone actually like read these or do you own them? Like genuinely, like, because I will sometimes like dip into this and I'd be like, this is dry. Like, I would read it for the sake, I read it for the reason that, you know, I've got to read this history book about black history or queer history. But I'm also like, it's not that enjoyable. You'd read it and you'd be like, this was so informative and it was really intelligent, but did you enjoy it? And people don't really discuss that aspect. So I knew that I wanted to write something which was enjoyable, which people could really, but also I also wanted to make sure that I also, you know, as much as you said, you know, like the kind of Gen Z thing, and it's gisty and it's gossipy, it also takes the reader seriously as well. It takes the intelligence of the reader seriously too. And that's why, like, I was, like, candid about my emotions and I was candid about my relationship with this man, because I thought, like, the reader is serious enough to understand that as much as some of these interactions are expressed quite casually, it is still faithful to the kind of, like, historical and intellectual integrity of the project. So I wanted to marry all of those things. Like, at no point, I mean, I guess the readers can give that feedback, but, like, at no point do I feel like I was trying to, like, condescend my reader or kind of do a kind of, like, hey, this is this for dummies. I kept the complexity and the intelligence of it, but I just relayed it in the way that it was being relayed. I think it would have been more dishonest if I'd had these real gisty conversations with these men and then I'd like, gone and academized it and made it sound really scholarly. That's not what happened. You know, I was turning up at like 8 p.m. in my shorts and kind of just like sitting there like that and having a lovely chat. So it just wasn't, it was never like us in the room of like, I don't know, like a Cambridge office and just like, so what happened to it? I wanted to keep everything as much as what I could of what it actually was like doing this kind of research. And also to say that, like, anyone else can do this kind of research as well. Like, even if it's literally just chatting to your nan about, you know, what she got up into in the 1950s or whatever. Like, it literally is just about that.
It just feels fundamentally black and queer to me.
Yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So let's talk about the individuals. So we open with Ted Brown, Ted Walker Brown. So you met Ted through Mark.
Yeah.
And Ted's sort of probably the eldest contributors. And so he gives us a grand sweep, really, of pretty much the whole second half of the 20th century. Mm. What did you glean from Ted? What sort of emerged for you?
What did I glean from Ted? I think that Ted's resilience is like nothing that I've ever witnessed before. And also, you know, he's someone who grew up with like a very early sense of his sexuality and almost felt kind of doomed by it. And one thing that he really emphasized was that he never felt any kind of shame around his sexuality. But he was growing up at a time where there are no gay organizations, you know, homosexuality is not being decriminalized yet. He has no mechanism for meeting people yet. Like, he's, you know, really stressed about this fact that he's like, I don't know what my future actually looks like or if there is a future for me. And then he ends up meeting the Gay Liberation Front and joining them and, you know, helping to organise the first Pride March. And
he was involved in the famous kissing.
Yeah, yeah. And from Ted, I just kind of realised that, you know, that activism is a service, you know, for these men. It's like a lifetime of dedication. Like, he's still an activist. Like, I remember he was like messaging me if I was going to like the Trans Life Matter march, and I was like super hungover. And I was like, oh, unfortunately I can't make it, I'm busy. And I just felt like so ashamed of myself. So I'm like, this man is like in his 70s, up at the crack of whatever, 6 a.m. or something, ready to go and march, you know, for the rights and justice of people. So I just think he had such a kind of like burning but tempered rage and like real sense of anger against injustice that I just thought was, you know, just absolutely incredible.
Because, I mean, you know, going from being part of the Gay Liberation Front in the early 1970s to being on the front line when it came to Section 28, and along with Dergob Richards, who we'll talk about shortly, sort of sticking up for Justin Fashanu, who's another figure who's, you know, if he'd lived in Brixton, he'd be central to this story, but it's very much about who lived in Brixton and who was black and queer at the time. What sort of impact did Ted have on the politics and, you know, as a frontline activist during Section 28 in particular, I would say?
I'd say he was someone who was really challenging of media homophobia and was really challenging of this kind of compulsion to hide yourself. So with Justin Fashanu, when he did come out, there was this like front page Voice article which used, you know, his brother John Fashanu to talk about, basically to degrade him and say, you know, he's a disgrace, blah, blah. But within that, there was Tony Seale, who had written this article about, you know, like homosexuals are the worst queer bashers and they need to go back to their closets, things like that. And, you know, Ted talks about being so intense by this. And Tony Seale, by the way, is the same guy who wrote, you know, The Race Report, which is, you know, heavily discredited. So when I kind of made the link, I was like, this guy has always been a dickhead. I can't believe like he's been able to, I cannot believe that he has been going for this long. And he is just like, there was even
straight facts,
even an article from like 2003 in The Guardian where he talks about, you know, black boys are too feminized. Like, it's just like every stage of your life, you've just chosen to be a dickhead.
But the thing is, like, you know, the lady doth protest too much, no?
I don't know. What Ted was really instructive about was showing that, you know, black gays and lesbians are not ashamed to be who they are and they don't deserve to be degraded. And that's even in times where, you know, you're being blamed for the international AIDS crisis and you're kind of seen as this vector of disease. You're seen as someone who needs to really, like, close yourself off and minimise yourself. He was very much about, you know, being out and out and, like, putting pressure on different organisations to make sure that they were respecting, the, you know, the dignity of black homosexuals and all homosexuals, I guess.
And Dergob Richards, who was very much alongside Ted through all of that, he was more of the god of small things. There are people like Ted and Alex Otawolade who were sort of more kind of grand in their gestures and sort of more radical. but Derg was equally important in the small ways.
Yeah, so you had people like Ted and Derg who were the ones. I mean, Derg would also like go on protest marches, but they were more kind of like the voices and the faces of things, and they were these kind of like big, loud, boisterous activists. Whereas you had someone like Derg who is more timid, and you know, he describes what the work that he does as a modest revolution. But what that means is that, you know, if you are booking a meeting room, I don't know, for the meeting of like the Black Lesbian and Gay Centre to, I don't know, discuss this protest march that they're going to go on, for example. His point is that, you know, you need someone to set up the chairs, and you also need someone to clean up the room so that you get the meeting room next week and they don't ban you. He's also someone, you know, who's in charge of all of this administrative work. You know, I kind of emphasise, something that's really emphasised in the book is communication. That's why, you know, the front cover has like a phone on it. This is like before you can just send off, I don't know, a mass WhatsApp broadcast or a tweet, you know, to tell everyone to come. I mean, most people would have seen and come here based off of tweets, right? I didn't have to go and find everyone's like mailing address and send out an invitation. It didn't work like that. I wasn't having to like literally like put loads of posters on the wall, hand out flyers outside the station. But those are the kinds of things which, you know, Doug would have to do. He would have to find people's mailing addresses. He would also have to kind of like mark which people would have to be sent things more discreetly, you know, if they were, you know, particularly vulnerable or live with their family who might, you know, object to their homosexuality. If there was, you know, a death and there needed to be, you know, people needed to be organized to, you know, come and gather and mourn very quickly, he was the kind of person who would, you know, take someone's file effects, go through all of those addresses, type up the invitations and kind of like tirelessly go and send them out. So I think that Derg does speak to those, you know, smaller, laborious tasks which are less glamorous and we don't necessarily think of when we think of activism, but absolutely are activism.
Mm. I mean, one of the most important things that he did that we remember today is the Black Gay Men's Conference of 1987. And that sort of brings in Ajamu, who came down from Huddersfield to attend this. So Black Gay Men's Conference, people from all over the country came down to attend. I think there were 70 gay black men, and in your book, Ajamu was quoted as saying he'd never seen more than four black gay men before. So that was kind of an incredible thing, an incredible moment. And speaking of Ajamu, he sort of, I mean, you just mentioned communication. I think that's a really important thing because people's lives were at stake if certain information about HIV testing in the mid to late 80s, for example, wasn't disseminated. I'm not sure that that's quite the right word to use in this context, but, or, you know, even turning it into, you know, a positive thing, where can we go to, you know, be in a black space where we can enjoy certain music and enjoy each other in that space? So Ajamu was called down from Huddersfield to attend the Black Gay Men's Conference, and Ajamu has become this incredible sex activist, an incredible artist. What was it like interviewing him? Because he's a friend of mine and I know that he's just an incredible character. Tell us more about him.
Yeah, Ajamu is intense. Ajamu is very... Ajamu will make it very clear that he is cruising you, or that he is thinking, he's thinking about you naked or something like that. He's just very... He's very intimate and like unapologetically, you know, very sexual as well. And, you know, that's obviously, you know, the basis of a lot of his work. Like a lot of his work is, you know, nude portraits of black men, you know, in different positions.
You can see some of Ajamu's portraits of Jason in the current issue of Butt magazine. Just saying.
The first time I've ever posted my arse on Instagram. and the last.
They're beautiful.
And the last. But Ajamu just has this fascination with black men's bodies. And I think that it was so essential because, you know, I could have written, it's really weird how easy it is to write like about gay lives or gay history without talking about sex ever. You could do that. Like even when, you know, people talk about the AIDS crisis, like the AIDS crisis happens because people are having sex. And sometimes you can just have entire discussions, read entire things, which just really erase that. And for Ajamu, he's like, you come to this identity and you come to know yourself through desire. And that's why I write him. Ted Brown talks about the fact that he knew that he was homosexual because he was watching this film and he saw Harry Belafonte and he thought, I want some of that. And that's how he realized that he was a gay man. And that's how everyone has these experiences where they realize themselves because they desire someone, because they think about them sexually. So he was just really radical in, you know, emphasizing that and also emphasizing that there is no kind of like singular way to be a black man. So he was also the most challenging as well. Like he was probably the only one who would challenge something that I asked or something that I said. And he was very explicit about the fact that he might politically disagree with people. He might think that, you know, some people's politics are too sexually conservative, or that they're not, you know, particularly embracing enough. And also, he was someone who was, you know, really keen to resist politicization of all of his work. Because I guess that I can imagine if you're someone like a Jammu and you're making all of these, you know, if you're making all of these photographs of, you know, black gay men's bodies. So I think something that he said was that sometimes people would like respond to his work and he would say, you know, well, this shows, you know, the resistance of black gay men during the AIDS crisis to show that they were free with their sexuality. And he's like, no, I just like it. This is just pleasurable. This is purely pleasure. This is pleasure because, you know, pleasure is good. And why can't pleasure itself be a principle? Why can't pleasure be the end rather than this means? You know, that was extremely important for me as well to think about. And that also helped me think through, why am I doing this work? Because I guess that, like, it would be really, I could sit here and say, you know, I did this work because, you know, I come up with all of the political arguments about the archive, about, you know, things being lost, about, you know, the like political importance of like preserving our lives. But also, it was just pleasurable. I wouldn't have, as important as this is, if I wasn't going to enjoy this, I obviously wouldn't have done it. You know, there's lots of things that are important that people won't do because it's not enjoyable, right? So I also was really emphatic that for me, this was also just really pleasurable. And that, I think that's something which is, you know, repeating the fact that you go to a museum. And so let's say like the Life Between Islands Museum, Life Between Islands exhibition that happened at Tate Britain that, you know, people literally like flocked and poured into. Or the fact that, you know, we have these like black digital archives popping up where you're asking for submissions of photographs from, I don't know, Notting Hill Carnival back in like 1980. Or you're looking at, you know, black life outside London, all these photographs. It's like, it's pleasurable to look at these things. It's nice. There's a nice kind of feeling experience, which is hard to define and put down other than the point of pleasure. And it's like, actually, that pleasure sometimes is enough. We don't always have to reach for all of the kind of political contexts. So Ajamu really helped me rethink and reframe a lot of my writing. I remember after my conversation with him, I went like through what I'd written so far in terms of like notes, and I added things and I changed things and I reframed them. And I also just thought in a way which I thought was more intelligent and also more honest.
Yeah, I've interviewed Ajamu a couple of times and written pieces and then gone back to them a couple of years later and gone back to my original interview, and I was like, well, there's another interview that as well. There's another piece there.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much that that is in everything that he says.
Yeah.
I'm going to pause for a second to ask if anyone in the audience has any questions. Yes.
Hey.
We have roving mic.
Thank you so much for writing this book. It's very important. As a South Londoner, I connect to it in a very deep way. And I guess I've got like so many questions. Without reading it, I'm sure they'll be answered. But when in your conversation with these men, how were sex parties organized? Because I find it incredible that, as you said, these days it's very easy to have easy communication. But how that happened, and also today, how would you suggest we archive our own experiences as queer people? You know, Twitter is sort of like the heart of a lot of conversations, but I think very soon that's just going to depreciate and so much culture is going to be lost. So that's like my twofold question.
Yeah. Sex parties, how they were organized back in the day. So basically it was kind of like within your own sex. You'd start within your own sexual network. So if you're having sex with somebody and, you know, they're not lying to you that you're not the only one having sex with, they would, you know, then go, you'd basically pass on this information to them and they would pass them on to their sexual partners, basically people who they felt were open to this kind of thing. And they would, you know, distribute flyers as well, which, you know, showed, so basically sex party that Ajamu organized was called the Black Purpose Network. And, you know, he has these incredible like colored flyers, which would have all of these details of information, and it would have everything except for the actual address, right? So then Ajamu, all of the kind of like phone numbers of all of these people would then get back to Ajamu, and then like an hour before the party would happen, the address would then be released, kind of like an illegal rave. The reason for that is, you know, this is the Drama Zone house, so there's obviously safety to navigate. So you have to make sure, it's basically like it's a trust network. You have to make sure that you are only passing this on to someone who is going to be into this and is also going to be very safe. But also Ajamu operated the policy where he would turn people away at the door if he felt that they were not part of the kind of brutal sexual network, if he just didn't like them, you know, if there was someone who had just got somehow caught wind of this or this been leaked. He ran like a very strict role around mission because he's like, well, this is my house. I can choose who I let in or not. This isn't like a public ticketed event or something like that. So yeah, it was kind of like based on this sort of whisper network. And how do we archive? I mean, it's a difficult question, but it's something that I've been thinking about. I mean, recently we saw that, I mean, it's not been taken offline just yet, but Vice is going to be like taken offline, and like a lot of people's journalism is just going to go like that. I mean, I'm glad some of my articles are going, to be honest, but anyway. But basically, I just think that we take so much for granted. We just assume that everything on the internet is forever. And I think that's kind of because, like, you know, like when we were young, I don't know, maybe when we were young at school, it's like, you know, if you post something on the internet, you can't get it back, it's forever. And then someone, I remember reading a really good tweet the other day where someone was like, what happened to websites? And I didn't know what they meant at first, but then I was like, actually, yes, I get what you mean. What did happen to websites? If you think about like the number of websites you probably used, like, I don't know, when you were like 14 or something, and now, everything has been condensed to like the same regular apps, and you might go on like one website for a very specific purpose. But if you think about that, like lots of these different websites now, you know, would have been lost. I mean, I remember I once like read this like Black British gay blog years ago, and then I came to return to it and it was gone. It was just gone. I don't even know, because it was like, there was no like name to it. I actually had no idea who the person who even operated it was. It's kind of like, I just took for granted that this thing would always be there because it's the internet, it will always be there. So I kind of think like people actually need to make efforts to preserve things physically, but also that's difficult. So as a writer, my way of preserving things is that if I'm ever in a newspaper with writing or a magazine or something, I keep a copy of that. But even then, like, look, I live in my mum's house in the bedroom, like, space is so limited to the point where under my bed is where I keep like all of these magazines and newspapers, and it's full. So it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to need to, you know, look for, you know, more and more different storage facilities. I think like thinking about even just going back to taking like physical photographs with like a digital camera and things like that, just really going back to basics and thinking about like owning things. I mean, it's like, even I honestly think that we're going to kind of go full circle where people are even going to start buying DVDs again, because it's kind of like you go to Netflix to watch something and it's been taken off. I think everyone is just a bit fed up. And I think the internet has just, you know, the internet has sold a lot of kind of like false promises that people are now waking up to. So I'm really pro a physical revolution and everyone going back to basics, like buy a DVD player, buy a digital disposable camera where you can print out and keep those photos. That personally, that's what I think. I'm actively taking more efforts to do those kind of things.
Did I see a hand at the back first? Yes.
I just wanted to ask, were there any big challenges that you experienced when trying to publish this book? And B, like, how did you overcome them?
Okay, so being like totally honest, my publishing journey was smoother than I guess a lot of people's were, in the sense that, you know, I was someone who was writing a lot and I had agents reach out to me, so that made the process a bit easier. I can't lie about that. Like, obviously people, you know, struggle to get agents, and that, you know, is definitely a thing. But I think the struggle for me was actually more mental. I kind of remember thinking, who the hell is going to want to read this very specific book about black gay men? Like, this isn't even something which is really like discussed as like a category of people. These aren't conversations people are having. And also, I'm even going to take it back like 30, 40 years to stuff that was going on in the 1980s. I just remember mentally thinking, do I have a book? Who's going to care? And a lot of the time, that was almost a way of me kind of trying to talk myself out of pitching the book or writing the book. Or sometimes, I remember there's this thing with like, black nonfiction, I could talk about the state of black nonfiction for hours, but I'm not going to right now. It's almost as if you have to kind of write in all of these like memoiry aspects. So you have to talk about like, I was a victim of racism and this is how white people made me feel, to be able to sell your book. And it's like, over my dead body, was I going to write something like that? But I was also there thinking, if I did that, six figures. So I remember having this kind of battle where I was like, I want to write what I want to write, but also I want to, you know, write something that's going to sell, that people are going to buy. Because you do have to think about the market. You're always forced to think about these things. And in the end, I was like, do you know what, Jason? Even if it sells nothing and no one cares, even if like five people had turned up here, I still wrote the book that I wanted to. But then I kind of realized that actually that is just my strength. And like, I think people try and kind of like treat the market, or they try and like repeat what has been successful before. But the most successful books have been something that has been different at the time that they were published, right? They've been something which has kind of been like trailblazing in some way, or someone who's just done something that they wanted to. I mean, Catherine Rundell, who's also my publisher, wrote this like really specific book about John Donne, and it has literally been sweeping awards. It is such a rave, and she just wrote the book that she wanted to. Like, no one would necessarily think like, oh, this book about John Donne is just, you know, going to go super viral, be really big and be really good. So yeah, it was, for me, it was the mental challenge to be able to say and confidently be like, actually, Jason, write what you want to write. It doesn't matter how niche, how specific it is. And like anyone who ever wants to write a book, I always give them that advice. I'm always like, don't think about what's worked before, what everyone else has written. What do you want to write? What do you want to say? How do you want to tell it? Because even me to say like, I want to write a history book, but I don't want it to be even slightly academic. I want it to be super conversational. That wasn't something that I had seen, but I mean, I'll get my sales figures next week. We'll see if it pays off.
Well, looking forward to reading the book, and thank you for your time and for having us. Slightly different question. Do you think, obviously you're trying to get these men's stories and these men's lives out. Do you think, I hate using the phrase mainstream media, but I'm going to use it. Mainstream media could do more to get these stories out, because it's just really, really, I think one of the many things I'll take away is what you said about how hard it is to find this stuff, and what you just said about websites. I was like, of course, that's so really, really powerful. But in terms of mainstream media, mainstream journalism, just in 30 years time, there might be someone trying to find your journey again and bring it like a 30-year anniversary book, who knows. And it would just be interesting to know what you think mainstream media and what mainstream, I don't know, companies and all of these people can do, so in 30, 40, 50, 60 years time, there'll be another scene maybe coming up in Brixton or wherever else, and be good if people don't have to fight as hard as you did to get these people's stories heard.
My answer to that might surprise you. I came to the conclusion that actually I kind of wanted mainstream media away from this in a way. I'm kind of glad that this was kind of, obviously I've got a publisher and everything, but this is also kind of me of my own volition. Like no one set me up to do this, deciding I really want to find out about that story. And then I found the apparatus to support me. And I say that because, you know what, the men in, like this book will never be a documentary. And the reason for that is that the men in this book spoke to me. I mean, there's some of them who would be comfortable to, I don't know, go on like Sky or like the BBC and talk or something. But like a good handful of those men would only talk to me. They're like, in their mind, they're like, I'm doing this because I like this guy and I trust him and maybe I see a bit of myself in him. So being able to have that kind of really personal relationship means that actually there is only one way that these conversations were going to come out. I mean, obviously there would be other people who they were close to and who would have the skills to have been able to have written a book like this and have those conversations. But I like the fact that this wasn't like me being commissioned by, I don't know, some big broadcaster to do some kind of like really choppy documentary or like piece of work on Black gay life. I mean, sometimes what was interesting is that some of those men spoke about that they had experiences of, I mean, this isn't in the book because this was just kind of our conversations. They spoke about, I don't know, like chatting to The Guardian or giving comment to a piece like back in 2002. Well, there was one thing that Biggie said. So this is part of some of the content that I was looking at, but then decided to chop for artistic reasons. The Guardian was doing the whole like murder music, Jamaica, is it safe? And then Biggie was talking about the fact that sometimes at like gay raves, they played some of that music kind of ironically. And then the Guardian wrote this story about like, yeah, Biggie C just doesn't think it's a big deal. And apparently he got like a lot of backlash in the community. And he was just there like, no, the Guardian really pushed that on me, really spun what I said, because they wanted a particular narrative. They wanted like that alternative view, and they just were forcing it. Right. So he was really, really, really frustrated. And he actually ended up getting like a kind of like correction published, because he just like complained to the editor and was like, people are literally like insulting me because of the way you've spun my story. And then what's really fascinating is that The Guardian extracted my book. And when they emailed, they were like, the chapter we want to extract is the one with DJ BKC. I was like, oh, fuck. Okay. How am I going to break this to him, considering, you know, what happened back in 2002 and these men could hold a grudge? So I remember I spoke to him, I told him, he was like, okay. I was like, okay, it's all right. And I could tell he was a bit apprehensive, but it was fine. And then it came out, I did not send him a message. I was waiting for him to message me, but also thinking, Lord, is he going to be like, Jason, what have you done? But he was like, thank you so much. Like, you have actually, like, you've represented me properly. I feel like my voice was there. He went and bought a copy of the paper, and like he literally like put it on his Instagram and everything, and I just felt very proud. I'm kind of like, I'm glad it was me that did this. I'm glad it wasn't just some journalist on an assignment. I'm glad this was something that I had committed myself to for years, and something that I'm also like continuing to do. So yeah, it's weird, like we talk about wanting to increase media representation, but I just kind of say, you know, be careful what you ask for.
I was kind of wondering, like, I think sometimes there is a risk with like history, particularly regarding like marginalized communities, that non-marginalized people feel like it was like a long time ago. Like they're just like, oh, it's past, it didn't happen. Or like, it did happen, but like we're over it now, we're post that, you know.
And I was just kind of wondering, like, having, like, researched that decade, that period of history, and now, like, and writing about it in this time, and being, like, a Black, queer, or gay person yourself, like, have you had any kind of reflections on kind of, like, how far we've come, or, like, whether we are that, like, post, you know, whatever happened society, and kind of, like, what, or whether you see any, like, similarities in, like, a lot of the political discourse and, like, issues that are happening today, to comparatively to the conversations and the stories that you've, like, heard in terms of researching the book?
Yeah, the political discourses are, like, strikingly identical. Like, right-wingers are so uncreative. So back when, so let's say, like, when the, like, Black Lesbian Gay Centre, when they were trying to set that up, you had, like, so Ken Livingstone was the kind of, like, head of the Greater London Council, which was funding all of these kind of, like, fringe minority projects. So obviously these right-wingers were like, oh my God, you know, these lefties are so concerned with these fringe minority issues, which is, you know, something that we, again, that's basically, you know, woke discourse of today, right? So it's just, it was so repetitive. I just thought, oh, we're actually never getting free. Like, in 20 years' time, they're going to be doing this again and, like, calling it something else. So that was, like, quite striking for me to see those parallels. But I also think, you know, I went into this book, and this is, like, one thing where I was kind of, like, you know, challenged on my view. I went into this book expecting everything to be a bit of a shit show back then and to be better now. But actually, I left it kind of like, you guys kind of had it all right. I mean, obviously, there was AIDS, so let's not... But, like, sorry, that was a bit too glib. But I remember, so Mark Thompson was talking about leaving his mum's house. And he said, yeah, so I wanted to leave my mum's house. So I went down to council and I got a flat. I was like, whoa. I was like, repeat that. He was like, you would just go down to the council, you'd say, hi, you know, I want to live by myself, and they would give you a flat. And I was just like, Jesus, we have decimated social housing stock in this country to the point where, like, if any of your friends live in there, you're like, you're rich, come on, you know, you've made it. Like, this was just something he was able to do. He was just able to have his own nice flat, and the council would provide that to him. So that was just the benefit. And that also means that, you know, if you have these men who have their own flats, they're able to host parties, they're able to, you know, socialize much in a much better way. They don't necessarily have to wait for, like, the one club night. And then, speaking of club nights, when they're, you know, building up this kind of, like, nightlife structure, there's actually much more of an abundance of options. You know, there are all of these regular house parties. There are a lot more nights. Like, they list all of these nights, like the Lyft, Caribana, the Lowdown, the Vox, like, they just were listing so many, like, different Black gay nights. And I just thought, actually, you guys' nightlife was a lot more popular than ours was. Like, we our nightlife options have just become so limited. And the big reason for that is money, right? You know, and it's interesting because obviously they were still, you know, working with a shoestring budget in those days, or, you know, having to, you know, I don't know, like, take over an abandoned building or something and run when the police came. But I also just think they had more money to be able to invest in certain things. So there was, like, a guy called Vincent Osborne who opened up a bar in Brixton called the Brixtonian, which became this, like, Black gay spot, like, literally just this, like, pub, right? But now, if you come into some money, are you going to set up this business or this, you know, nightclub? No, you're going to put that deposit into a house because of the housing market. You're forced to use your money literally just for housing. Housing that was a lot more accessible and cheap, you know, back in those days. So I was, obviously, it was kind of like the obvious ones were like, you know, HIV is not a death sentence in the same way that it was back then. And, you know, attitudes toward those things have improved. And media representation has improved. But actually, the social political conditions, we're talking about people who lived through Thatcher, right? The social political conditions and economic conditions, when they were talking about that, I was kind of like, well, this actually sounds kind of better. Like, I couldn't even believe that I was even saying that. And it wasn't even to, like, undermine that. I'm not even saying that there were no issues in housing and housing discrimination back in those days. But I just thought, I can't, if I went down to the council, I was like, give me a flat, I would just get laughed at. I, even to, like, put my name on the council tenancy has been, like, a massive battle that I've still not won. So it was just, yeah, it was, when I think about, every time I think about that, I feel a little bit angry. So next question.
Well, I mean, we shouldn't forget that Thatcher just basically sort of spent her entire ministry rowing back on everything that Labour had introduced in the previous decade.
Yeah.
But also, just to sort of pick up on something you're asking, in terms of, there's a quote that you've got from Ted in the book where he uses that quote of Thatcher's from 1987, where she says, you know, children are being raised feeling that they have the inalienable right to be gay. sounds a lot like the rhetoric now in terms of trans identity and trans expression.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what I sort of took from your question. Do you want to say anything about that quickly, or should we?
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much said that, I think. Okay. Absolutely.
I saw a hand just behind. Yes, in the middle.
Thank you both for speaking with us today. I'm super excited to read the book, as I'm sure everyone else is here. Two questions in one, and you kind of half already answered one of them. You said you didn't want the mainstream media anywhere near this. Does that include something more creative, like an anthology series? I know things like Small Axe were very well received. I think it would be amazing to see this on the screen. I am a bookworm, but definitely love Netflix a bit too much. So seeing this on the screen would be amazing. And secondly, do you think, obviously, you have a gift for building trust and putting these amazing stories into wonderful prose? So do you think that's something you could take to other countries like Nigeria, maybe America? Is that something you've considered?
So when I talk about mainstream media, to be honest, I was more talking about journalists. So in terms of like creating an adaptation, I'd be like happy to like explore that. I mean, that's a question for my agent, and that's a future consideration, I guess, with what to do with this. I mean, I would personally like favor like an adaptation over a documentary, because again, as I said, like, I just, the kind of like relationships and interactions I had with these men is not something that can just be recreated in such an easy way. But to answer your question about like, you know, whether I take that to another country, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know what my book two will be, or if there will be a book two. Like, this for me, the reason I did this was because I was very particular about Britain. I really wanted to write something that was specifically British, and that much is like very evident in the book. And that's why I like kind of situate them within like a very British political context and within like a very British location, being South London. And obviously I have that connection to Britain. Like, Nigeria, I've only been to Nigeria once, and you know, don't have like a connection to the USA, so I don't think I'd be able to recreate that element as well, to be honest, if I were to go to other locations. I mean, even the fact that like this had to be South London, like it had to, like I'm South London nationalist, it was never going to be a North London book. So yeah,
let's question, have one yeah. more question.
Hi, what's your name? It's my brother.
Hi. You talk, you cover in the book, like, the relationship between blackness and queerness, and that's often seen as, like, a contradiction within the black mainstream. Where would you sit that now compared to, like, the time of, like, the book?
I think there are definitely still those people who see, you know, being black and gay as like an inherent contradiction. They might think that you have kind of, like, exiled yourself to the white gay community, or they might not understand that, you know, if you're black and gay, you might also have relationships with other people who are black and gay. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're like within like a white scene. But I remember, you know, I thought about this recently, like in the context of where I go out to party. I remember I was thinking about this. I remember when I was like much younger, I used to almost only go to like specifically black queer spaces because I just felt safer there. I was having more fun there. My friends were there, etc. But now more recently, I kind of go to quote unquote straight like black nights and spaces, and I go there confidently, and there'll be lots of gay people there blended in, and that's not a thing. And I'm like, okay, actually this does feel like progress, and it does feel like there's no one making you feel weird. Like, I remember back when Vision's video bar was a thing, I remember going once and feeling really uncomfortable just because people made me feel uncomfortable, because I was just like very obviously gay, and I was like dancing with girls, but like dancing in the way where I was one who was bent over. So but I don't feel like I have that experience as much anymore. And I would say that like there definitely has been progress. And the reason that there has been progress is because people have been more vocal, and people have been like more insistent on, you know, being in the spaces. And, you know, like lots of my friends are straight as well. Why would I like excuse myself from going out with them, or like associating with them, or being at their weddings and being like part of their kind of like broader families, because of like people's perception of contradiction? So yeah, I definitely think that there has been that progress, but also these dynamics still existed back in those days as well, right? People might have seen this as a contradiction, but these men in the book are very much like, no, this wasn't a contradiction. So, like, this isn't a book about, like, black gay men who are minorities amongst the gay community. This is a book about black gay men who had, like, a massive community of them to themselves. And that's what the narrative focuses on. So I kind of just always wanted to make that, like, incredibly emphatic that, like, this is a book about black men. It's not about black men in response to whiteness or in the response to racism. It's just about black men. Like, that was always, like, the focus.
Thank you, Jason. That was absolutely incredible. Congratulations Thank on you. Writing an incredible, important, brilliant and beautiful book. And it better not be your last one. I think I could speak on behalf of your publisher and agent. Please grab one of these copies. Don't want to see any left.
Signing
and,
as well.
I know his arms are already huge, but I want them to be even bigger from signing. And there's three of mine as well. You don't need to. You've all read it anyway. Please join me in thanking and congratulating Jason.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.